Sando Trafficante Jr. is considered one of the most influential and powerful mobsters in American history. He ran the Tampa crime family for more than 30 years, but he also had wide-reaching influence and power throughout the United States and even in Cuba. I'm Brian McCoy. Welcome to The Mob Files. All right, everyone, welcome into episode 2 of The Mob Files. Today, our subject is Sando Trafficante Jr. Trafficante was born on November 15, 1914 in Tampa, Florida. He officially took over as boss of the Tampa crime family bearing his name in 1954 when his father, Sando Trafficante Sr., passed away. In reality, at the time of his father's death, Sando Jr. had been running things for a few years because his father was very sick, and Sando Jr. had been heavily involved in operations for decades at that point anyway. Sando Sr. was boss of the family from around 1940 until his death, and had been the underboss for 20 years prior to taking the top job. It's important to discuss Sando Sr. because he laid the groundwork that made it possible for Sando Jr. to become so powerful. Sando Trafficante Sr. was born in Sicily in 1886. He came to the United States at the age of 15 and shortly thereafter moved to Tampa. This makes sense as Tampa had a large Sicilian population at the time. Early on, his main racket was bootlegging during Prohibition. Tampa was a natural hotspot for bootlegging given its position on the water, made it easier to get supplies in. Trafficante operated primarily in the Ybor City neighborhood of Tampa. It was there that he moved into his other primary racket, Bolita Lotteries. In a Bolita Lottery, 100 number balls are placed into a bag. People then place bets on which ball will be drawn out. Things weren't always easy going for Sando Sr. The 1930s were an extremely violent time in Tampa, so violent that it became known as the Era of Blood. During this time, rival organized crime factions fought for control of gambling in the city and the region. The three big players were Trafficante Sr., Charlie Wall, and Ignacio Antonori, who was at that time the boss of the Tampa family. Wall is a fascinating character. His dad was a prominent physician and politician in Tampa, even serving as the mayor, and his mother was from a prominent family as well. Despite all this, Wall quickly became entrenched in the criminal underworld. He operated in Ybor City and ran a crew of Italians, Cubans, and Irish. He had significant influence in the legal system and used it to get judges and other officials in his pocket. Antonori and Wall waged all-out war on each other during the Era of Blood. Antonori was murdered at a restaurant in October of 1940. Wall avoided death during this period, but his power was greatly diminished. Sando Sr. seized the opportunity to expand his power. He became the official boss of the Tampa crime family and united what factions were left over. During the 40s and 50s, Sando Sr. built lasting relationships with other families in the United States and began to expand his gambling operations in Cuba. Due to a number of reasons, including failing health and heat on the mob from the federal government, Sando Sr. passed control of day-to-day operations to his son Sando Jr. in 1950, but he remained the official boss until his death in 1954. Upon his father's death, Sando Trafficante Jr. became the official head of the crime family bearing his name. Based on the foundation put in place by his father, Trafficante quickly became influential not just in Florida, but throughout the United States and even in Cuba. Like his father, Trafficante operated largely in the Ybor City neighborhood of Tampa, Florida. To go along with the illegal gambling operations, Trafficante also had numerous legitimate business ventures, including bars. As you will hear later on, he was also running legitimate operations at the same time in Cuba. Another big moneymaker for Trafficante Jr. was drug trafficking. Sitting in Tampa, he was in a prime position to facilitate the import of drugs into the United States. One of the more amazing things about Trafficante was his ability to avoid trouble with the law. Other than a stint in a detention center in Cuba, he avoided jail entirely. He was arrested multiple times in the 50s for bribery, but was only convicted once, and that was eventually overturned. The lotteries conducted by Trafficante were the same Bolita lotteries his father ran. The game was illegal in Florida at the time, but the right people were paid off, and this allowed them to operate fairly freely. And even when Trafficante did get pinched, nothing really stuck. Trafficante ran the Tampa crime family with an iron fist, but that didn't stop attempts to take him out. In 1951, Trafficante was leaving his home in Ybor City when another vehicle drove up and opened fire. Traficante was wounded, but not seriously. Traficante responded with brutal force. Within 2 years, three of his rivals would be dead, including Joe Antonori, son of Ignacio Antonori. At that point, the message was clear. Trying to take on Traficante would not turn out well. Like the subject of our first episode, Nick Civella, Traficante was present at the 1957 Apalachin meeting. Unlike Civella, Traficante was one of the 60 mobsters arrested when police raided the property. For the reasons detailed earlier on, Traficante had a lot of influence nationally. Because of this influence and his father's existing relationships, Traficante maintained close ties with bigger families, including the Bonanos in New York and with the Chicago outfit. Like all of the mobsters arrested at the Apalachin meeting, Traficante ultimately avoided prosecution. As I've stated several times, the Traficantes not only controlled Tampa, they also had extensive operations in Cuba. Traficante Jr. moved to Cuba in 1955, but he had been involved in his father's operations there for many years prior to that. He controlled several casinos in Havana and was believed to be involved in operations at many more. Fidel Castro rose to power in the late 1950s in Cuba, and he was no friend of the mob. The feud between Castro and the mafia is well documented. Castro supporters despised the foreign corrupt influences in their country. Within a few years, all businesses were nationalized, eliminating any chance at running profitable operations for the mafia, and this drove them out of the country. Traficante specifically was banned from the country and his assets were seized. As I mentioned before, Traficante is already considered one of the most powerful mafia figures in history. I think it's safe to say that power would have multiplied several times over if it wasn't for Fidel Castro. The mafia weren't the only ones who had a problem with Castro. Obviously, the United States government wasn't a big fan either. Now, the Central Intelligence Agency accepted the fact that they had a common enemy with the mob and Castro. They decided that one of the paths they wanted to pursue to solve their Castro problem was enlisting the mob's help in eliminating him. The CIA approached Johnny Rosselli, who was involved with the Chicago outfit. The CIA's middleman offered him $150,000, but Rosselli insisted that it be done for free. Rosselli brought in Sam Giancana, who was boss of the Chicago outfit, and also Traficante, due largely to his extensive ties and connections in Havana. Multiple plots by the group to take out Castro failed. This includes plans to poison Castro's food and other plans to just take him out with force. Under threat of contempt of Congress, Traficante admitted that he had been recruited by the CIA to help take out Castro during a hearing in 1975. It's still hard to wrap my mind around this. The intelligence wing of the United States government sought out the help of organized crime bosses to defeat a foreign enemy. Our next topic is the JFK assassination. Yeah, I'm not kidding. I'm sure everyone is aware of the rumors of the mob's involvement in taking out JFK, but just to hit the high notes. The mob initially supported JFK because of their common enemy in Castro. The mob wanted to resume operations in Havana and would be open to help from just about any source to make that happen. Things didn't go exactly as planned when JFK's brother and the United States Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy made it his mission to go after the mob, to go after organized crime. In the late 1970s, an FBI informant told the press that Traficante Jr. had advanced knowledge of JFK's assassination. Traficante was hauled before Congress in 1978 and was questioned about this. He adamantly denied any such knowledge or involvement with plans to kill the president. He issued a wholesale denial that the mob in any way was interested in taking out Kennedy. Rosselli had testified before Congress in 1975 and was murdered shortly thereafter. There are several theories regarding his death, some of which are that he got too greedy with gambling profits and didn't share the wealth, but there are others who maintain that he was killed because he testified about this subject. Giancana was supposed to testify in 1975 as well, but was murdered just days before his scheduled appearance. It's important to know that these members of organized crime families could be killed for any number of reasons, but the timing is interesting to say the least. In the early 1990s, years after Traficante's death, his former lawyer claimed that he was told by Jimmy Hoffa, president of the Teamsters Union, to deliver a message to Traficante to have Kennedy killed. That lawyer's name is Frank Regano. He also worked for Jimmy Hoffa. Regano claimed that Hoffa and high-ranking members of the mafia wanted JFK killed due to Bobby Kennedy's crusade against the mob. Regano claimed that Traficante facilitated the murder. A House committee later concluded that while the mafia had the motivation and the means to take Kennedy out, the claims that they actually did so could not be substantiated. There were also rumors that Trafficante plotted to have Kennedy killed on November 18, 1963, during a visit to Tampa, and this was just days before his actual assassination. Again, these claims have never been substantiated. Alright, so moving on into the latter part of Trafficante's life. One of his last run-ins with the law stemmed from the famous Donnie Brasco operation by the FBI. The Bureau had successfully planted an undercover agent with the Bonanno family in New York. The agent's cover name was Donnie Brasco, posing as a jewel thief, but his real name is Joe Pistone. Pistone was undercover for more than 6 years, but his work ultimately led to more than 100 convictions of organized crime figures and associates. As a result, the Bonannos were kicked off of the commission due to their mistake of letting Pistone infiltrate their ranks. This actually may have ended up as a blessing in disguise for the family, as it kept the heat of the commission investigation off of them. This is a story for another day, but broad overview, the commission trial was the end result of a federal investigation in New York City focused on decimating the five families using RICO. And because the Bonannos had been kicked off the commission years earlier, there wasn't quite as much heat on them. Okay, getting back on track here. Trafficante was eventually a target in the operation. Pistone and other members of the Bonannos, including another undercover agent, were tasked with establishing operations in Florida. They opened the Kings Court Bottle Club north of Tampa. Now, because of the proximity of the club to Tampa and the respect Trafficante commanded, the New Yorkers brought him into the fold. They wanted to get his go-ahead before establishing these operations. Trafficante allegedly gave his blessing for them to do so. He was indicted on bribery and racketeering charges in 1983, stemming from that investigation. He was called into court to testify in 1986, but ultimately was never convicted. Santo Trafficante Jr. died in 1987 at the age of 72. Vincent Lo Scalzo took over as boss upon Trafficante's death, and still controls whatever is left of the family. However, it's believed that Tampa became open territory after Trafficante's death. This means that any of the five families from New York could come down and operate in Florida. It is known that a Gambino crew was operating in Tampa as of the early 2000s. The crew was led by John Gotti Jr., who was arrested and charged in 2008, stemming in part from his operations in Tampa. If there are still activities in Tampa, the remnants of the Trafficante organization are likely not involved. It's believed that there are only four remaining main guys from the Trafficante organization left, including Lo Scalzo. Lo Scalzo and two of the others are in their 80s. Antonio Amarelli, the youngest, is in his 70s. Early on in my research for this episode, I had this question that kept coming up. How did a boss of a very small family down in Florida have so much power and influence throughout the United States? How did he capture the attention of the five families in the Chicago outfit? But as my further research revealed, and as has been made obvious in this episode, it's not hard to see why. Trafficante controlled much of Florida for more than 30 years, and for a lot of that time had extensive operations in Cuba as well. Santo Trafficante Jr. was one of the last old-school mafia dons and ultimately one of the most respected in history. Thank you for listening to episode 2 of The Mob Files. If you enjoyed, please be sure to subscribe, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. Thanks again, and have a great day.